There was violence in France today during the second round of the national elections. An 18-year-old youth was shot to death in a city in northern France, and four people were wounded in Paris when police fired into a crowd of anti-Gaullist demonstrators. Once again, the hour's top story, American paratroopers ran into a force of 200 Viet Cong moving toward Saigon under cover of darkness. 38 communists were reported killed. Charles Quinn, NBC News, Washington.
Listen again on the hour when genuine General Motors parts bring you NBC Monitor News.
The San Francisco Story, brought to you by Jenkel Davidson Optical Company, serving all of Northern California. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bud Heide, inviting you to be the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for another half hour of the stories of San Francisco, the story-making towns and hills that surround it, and the people who made San Francisco's past so colorful. These impressions, written by Samuel Dixon, are brought to you each Sunday morning at this time by Jenkel Davidson, stylists in eyewear with offices throughout Northern California. We hope you enjoy today's story. Few of us are as troubled by perfect physical features as the hopeless young Narcissus, that character in Greek mythology who gazed away and fell in love with his own reflection in a pool of water. Most of us simply have to make the best of what we've got. And on top of everything else, you may say to yourself, and I've got to cope with glasses, too. Well, strangely enough, glasses can be a help in more ways than one. Not only can they help you see better, but they can help you look better as well. Ask the men at Jenkel Davidson. By expertly fitting the proper frame, they can make a broad forehead look narrower, a long nose look shorter, a thin face fuller, a round face leaner, and so on. The secret lies in combining the right shape, dimensions, color, and trim in your frame. And because Jenkel Davidson carries the most complete selection of frame styles anywhere, you can always be sure of finding the frame that will do the best by you. Bank credit cards honored. Now to our story. In the spring of 1772, an expedition led by the Italian explorer missionary Fra Juan Crespi sailed up the coast of California and entered San Francisco Bay. He landed on the east coast of the bay in the vicinity of what is now Berkeley, stood on the beach, and looked to the west. There before him, to the north and south, reached the broad blue waters of the harbor. And to the west, a path for the setting sun, lay the narrow strip of water through which his ship had sailed into the landlocked port. It was a beautiful and impressive sight, that narrow waterway, kindled to gold with the setting sun, a sight that merited an impressive name. So Father Crespi called it La Bocana de la Ensenada de los Farallones, the entrance to the Gulf of the Farallones. An impressive name, yes, an important name, but far too cumbersome a name. You couldn't possibly write poetry about a strip of water called La Bocana de la Ensenada de los Farallones. And when three quarters of a century later a poet came to the Bay of San Francisco, he chose a poetical name for it. Of course, he wasn't a poet in fact. He was actually a rugged pioneer and trailblazer, but he had the soul of a poet. And so he chose a poetical Greek name for the pathway of the setting sun, Chrysopyli. But even that was a cumbersome mouthful for the men who came to San Francisco in the year of the discovery of gold. So the literal translation was given to the beautiful Greek word, and La Bocana de la Ensenada de los Farallones became the Golden Gate. The name of that poet explorer was John Charles Fremont, an amazing man, one of the most amazing men ever to cross the mountains and plains. A man whose life was crowded with more drama and adventure than almost any other in the history of the building of America. And yet, week after week and month after month, we have set aside the telling of the story of Fremont in favor of the story of men much less important. And our reason is simple. We never knew what kind of a man John Charles Fremont was. We read book after book about him and found him presented as a hero, as a villain, as a poet, as an unscrupulous schemer, as a great statesman, as a cheap politician. Perhaps no other man in the history of our times has been hated by so many, worshipped by so many, reviled by so many, and idolized by so many. And worse, to add to our confusion, we find in reading of him that those who were his friends today were his enemies tomorrow, and those who hated him today were willing to lay down their lives for him tomorrow. John Charles Fremont was born in Savannah, Georgia, on January 21st in 1813. His mother was Anne Beverly Whiting, daughter of one of the first families of Virginia. The family wealth having been dissipated, a marriage was arranged between Anne and an elderly, gouty major of the Revolutionary War, John Pryor. That marriage lasted for some 14 years, and then Anne ran away with an attractive young Frenchman, an artist and teacher of French. Pryor sued for divorce, but because his own behavior had not been beyond reproach, the courts refused to grant the divorce. And 3 years later, a son was born to Anne Whiting Pryor and Charles Fremont, the French teacher. We have told this much about the parentage of Fremont because all biographers agree that it was the blot on the escutcheon of his family that was to influence to so great a degree his future life. A life of heroic endeavor and stupid frustrations. A life of glorious triumphs and dismal failures. The psychiatrist's inferiority complex had not been invented in the first half of the 19th century, but calling it any name you care to call it, the tragedy of Fremont's life was born of an inferiority complex inspired by his own knowledge of the stigma on his family name. The Frenchman Fremont died when John Charles was but 5 years old. And his mother, struggling through years of poverty, gave the boy a good education. He was a remarkable student, a mental prodigy. At 14, he had mastered the classic masters in the original Greek and Latin, and he reveled in poetry. He was teaching school between college semesters at the age of 17, an amazing preparation for a life of exploration, hardship, and savage adventure. The first adventure came when he was 20. There was revolt in South Carolina against the federal government, and President Jackson sent the sloop of war Natchez to Charleston to sustain law and order, and young Fremont went along in the capacity of teacher of mathematics to the middies. There was no war, so the Natchez sailed on to South America, and John Charles Fremont had his first taste of travel into strange lands. And a new Fremont was revealed, a scholar with a penchant for poetry, the classics, and mathematics, and an adventurer with an exhuming hunger for excitement and romance. He fell in and out of love with amazing ease, leaving a string of broken hearts from Charleston to South America. He was very handsome, very strong, something of a strutter. There was little evidence as yet of his inferiority complex, or perhaps our friend the psychiatrist will tell us that his strutting was a manifestation of his inferiority complex. But whether or not that was the case, scandal was whispered about young Fremont, and careful mothers built stone walls to separate him from their innocent daughters. But to the relief of many mothers, in 1836, Fremont went west as assistant to one Captain Williams who had been sent to survey the living conditions of the Cherokee Indians of Georgia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. That expedition planted in Fremont the love of the western lands and had a more significant result. His work brought him into constant contact with Indians, friendly and otherwise, and he learned to speak the languages of the tribes, learned their traditions and tribal customs, respected them, met them on an equal footing, and from that day and throughout his life, he was a friend of the American Indians, and they looked up to him as a white god. Meanwhile, on the trip, he had made topographical maps of the terrain covered, and upon his return, he was commissioned second lieutenant in the Topographical Corps. He was then sent to map the plateau country of the upper Mississippi River and on into the uncharted wilderness of the Missouri. Here was poetry. The sheer poetry of the wilderness, untamed by human hand. There were no limits to the horizon. The expedition went on and on into the wicked lands of South Dakota and down through the Red River Valley into the prairies of Colorado. And then, when the expedition came to an end, he returned to make his report to his superiors in Washington. In Washington, John Charles Fremont was greeted with a respect that he had never before known. He was now a youthful hero, and Washington society was pleased to lionize him. And society carried him to the home of an amazing giant of political Washington, Senator Thomas Hart Benton, senior senator from Missouri, with his family home in St. Louis. Back to John Fremont in a moment. This is that season when we squares who've grooved the business rut all year begin to think about taking our own kind of trip, drugged only by visions of getting away from it all, on vacation. May we remind you that among the brighter prospects of vacation is the fact of lots of sun at the beach, on the road, in the mountains, and lots of sun can put a strain on the eyes, unless you keep your cool with a pair of good sunglasses. Good sunglasses, of course, mean sunglasses from Jenkel Davidson. Good, because Jenkel Davidson sunglasses contain only the finest optically ground, glare-reducing, distortion-free lenses. So, remember, carry along a pair of Jenkel Davidson sunglasses on your next trip, local or long distance. If Jenkel Davidson has your prescription on file, you'll be surprised how fast they can deliver sunglasses made especially for you. Bank credit cards honored. Now, back to our story. John Charles Fremont was accepted into the home life of the Bentons in Washington. There were four Benton children, but Fremont had only met three of them. The fourth was away at school. He took the oldest daughter to a dance one night in Georgetown, a school dance and concert, and there he met the fourth child. She was 16 years old, an exquisite child, with flashing black eyes, black hair, a long, slender neck, and straight, fine shoulders. She was lovely. And John Charles Fremont fell in love that night, the one great love of his life. And destiny sealed the pact by making Dessie Benton fall in love with him. But now the road of the explorer-adventurer was to be complicated. The West was calling to Fremont, and his heart was in Washington. And Thomas Hart Benton and his good wife were alarmed. They had planned greater things for their lovely daughter than to be wedded to an all but unknown young explorer. Why, nothing was known of his background, nothing of his family. He was very handsome, it is true, and he had a good mind, but he was poor, he was a nobody, and, oh, well, it just wasn't suitable. The thing had to be stopped. So the Bentons did the only thing they could. They pulled political strings, and John Charles Fremont received orders to leave his topography desk and go west to survey the Des Moines River in the territory of Iowa. Well, here was the situation. Fremont loved Jesse, but he also loved exploration, and the orders were forget Jesse and exploring. John Charles argued with himself, argued with his superiors, argued with Jesse's father and Jesse's mother, and everybody in Washington excepting Jesse, who didn't care what he did as long as he knew he was doing the right thing and as long as he continued to love her. So he went west. After receiving Benton Sr.'s promise that if at the end of a year and at the end of the expedition the two misguided children still believed they were in love, then he might consider letting them consider themselves engaged. Well, you might as well give a child a stick of candy and tell him not to eat it. Fremont went to Iowa and contributed vastly to the settling of the wheat empire with his explorations on that trip. But he returned to Washington when just 6 months of the probation year had elapsed. And now Jessie had no intention of waiting longer. And this she told her senator father in plain words of one syllable. Senator Tom was shocked. Why, my goodness, he'd been engaged to Jesse's mother for 7 years before he had married her. Well, there was nothing to be gained by arguing with the adamant senator, so Fremont and Jesse decided to elope, and they went to friendly Protestant ministers, all of whom would have been pleased to marry the young couple, but not secretly. And finally, through the aid of the wife of the senator from Kentucky, they were married in a room of a Washington hotel and separated immediately after, John to return to his boarding house, Jesse to go to her parents' home. They kept the secret for a month and then decided to tell the senator. After all, Jesse was his daughter, cut out of the same cloth as he was, and she adored her father, and he adored her. So the next morning, they bearded the senatorial lion in his den. Tom Benton spluttered and stormed and shouted at Fremont. Get out of the house. Never cross my door again. Jesse shall stay here. But Jesse only smiled at her father, turned and took her husband's arm and said, Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Well, Senator Tom Benton could cope with oratory in the Senate chamber, but he had no answer for his daughter, save to splutter some more, and then growl and cough, and finally give up. And Jesse stayed at home, and John Charles Fremont moved into the Benton mansion. These were the years of Western exploration. Trails had been blazed by Lewis and Clark.